Welcome to today's webinar, Assessing the Magnitude and Trends in Hospital-Acquired Infections. I'm Catherine McGee, an Infection Prevention and Control Practitioner in London, Ontario. My co-presenter for this webinar is Kathleen McMullen, Director of Infection Prevention at Mercy Health System in St. Louis, Missouri. These are our speaker disclosures. This program is provided by HMP Education, an HMP global company, and is supported by an educational grant from 3M Healthcare Medical Solutions Division. The learning objectives for today's presentation are that you will be able to explain past and present healthcare-associated infection trends and challenges due to shifts in infection prevention priorities. Examine tips and strategies to rebuild and re-implement infection prevention practices related to bloodstream infections, and recognize how an infection prevention vascular access protocol may impact bloodstream infection risk reduction. The bloodstream infections discussed in this presentation will be catheter-related or central line associated bloodstream infections unless determined otherwise. Kathleen and I will each provide a high-level overview of healthcare-associated infection trends, challenges, and infection prevention priorities based on our respective Canadian and American perspectives. So what really determines healthcare-associated infection trends? Do they result solely from a lack of attention because infection prevention priorities have shifted away from something and onto another task? Are they newly identified infections that form trends because infection prevention have been directed to focus surveillance efforts on detecting and monitoring something? Do they result from the use of a new or improved diagnostic test? Are they national trends, regional trends, or is it a facility-specific trend? It really could be all of these. It's very complicated. Before we can look at healthcare-associated infection trends, we need to consider how the scope of practice of infection prevention and control and the skill set of practitioners has evolved over time. The points listed here are based on my experience in infection prevention and control since 1989. There's been a move from common sense to evidence-based practice. At the APIC conference in 2013, Dr. Julie Gerberding, former director of the Center for Disease Control, reflected on her early days as an infectious disease physician in the 1980s in California, where they first saw patients presenting with what became known as AIDS. She said, "When you don't have science, the next best thing is common sense." And that perfectly describes the early years of infection prevention. However, the reverse of that is, when we do have science, we need to reflect and reconsider what we knew as common sense. We need to follow science. And over the past 35 years, there's been a lot of infection prevention science that has formed the basis of evidence-based practice. Implementation science has provided us with methods and strategies to promote the adoption of evidence-based practice and research. And technology has made collection and analysis, communication and education more efficient. It has also enabled consistent identification of trends. As much as technology has helped us, it sometimes overwhelms us with information. When I started my infection prevention career, I was called an infection control officer, a rather negative title that speaks to old school authoritarianism and enforcement. And over time, the focus has shifted to downstream measures intended to prevent infections and not just being reactive to those already identified. Education is continuous and has increased along with new evidence. Education and learning should be lifelong. There have been multiple changes to isolation precaution systems and the application of personal protective equipment. There's been an increased focus on competency through completion of training courses and attaining the CIC credential through the Certification Board of Infection Control. In some areas of Canada, certification is a job requirement. You must already be certified or commit to achieving certification within a designated time period. Accountability and transparency has been incorporated through mandatory reporting. And infection prevention and control has expanded beyond the nursing profession to multidisciplinary healthcare workers. Patient safety, quality improvement, and interdisciplinary work is now the norm and requires expertise in change management strategies, worker engagement, and maintaining executive support. As our aging facilities are renovated and rebuilt, we require expertise in construction and hospital redesign, and we participate on antimicrobial stewardship teams to facilitate appropriate use of antibiotics. We must keep abreast of and participate in innovation and research and standardization of practice through the use of bundles. This expanded skill set has enabled us to recognize infections and infection risks we didn't know existed before, to identify new infections, and to build effective strategies for our prevention. In my experience, these are some of the determinants of infection prevention priorities in Canada. Mandatory reporting of indicators. These are dictated by provincial authority. They're intended to introduce transparency and accountability. The data must be posted on publicly available provincial and/or individual facility websites. Examples of the data posted is compliance with hand hygiene, C. difficile rates, MRSA bloodstream infection rates, compliance with surgical safety checklist, and preoperative antibiotic prophylaxis. All of these were still required during the pandemic and represent a lot of manual work in smaller facilities that may not have integrated infection prevention software or assistance to manage data. Accreditation Canada is an independent, non-governmental, not-for-profit organization that awards an accreditation standing to facilities based on in-person surveys to assess the delivery of quality and safe care and standardized practices. There are required organizational practices specific to infection prevention. Evidence must be provided that the required practices are established, functioning, measured, documented, and plans for improvement provided when necessary. CSA, or the Canadian Standards Association, creates standards of practice for facilities such as medical device reprocessing, construction, maintenance, and renovation, and participation in national surveillance studies. In 1995, the hospital I was working in at the time enrolled in a national surveillance program for identification of MRSA. And I remember the ID physician saying, "Don't worry, it won't be any work because we don't have any MRSA." And 6 months later, it was as if someone had parked the MRSA bus and unloaded the patients at our door. The surveillance work, transmission, and outbreak management overwhelmed us. The scope of national surveillance projects has continued and expanded to additional infections. Despite requirements from these external bodies that dictate some priorities, each practitioner is responsible for performing a facility or organizational assessment to ensure the program priorities, strategies, and tactics align with the strategic direction of the organization and address the current infections that are most impact morbidity and mortality in their facility. Another factor is the human health resources for infection prevention within the facility. How many bodies are there for the work? What is their level of expertise, and what is their scope of responsibility? And lastly, there are significant events that are labeled as marker events because they result in complete changes in knowledge, concepts, infection practices, and patients and or worker infections. I've listed here some events that I consider to be marker events since the start of my infection prevention career. It's hard to believe that when I began working in infection prevention in 1989, that we were educating on HIV and universal precautions. This was followed by antibiotic-resistant organisms and Clostridium difficile infections in the mid-1990s. Next came SARS in 2003 in Ontario that resulted in significant public health restructuring, increased funding, and new infection prevention initiatives, such as mandatory core competency education, measurements of hand hygiene compliance, and effectiveness of environmental cleaning, a true back-to-basics approach. H1N1 followed in 2008 and COVID-19 in 2020. Currently, in 2023, we're in the midst of a viral respiratory illness season with influenza A, RSV, and COVID-19 all circulating widely in our communities. Where I live, the wastewater signal for COVID-19 is currently 6 times higher than it was last year at the same time. Entire days can be filled with heightened surveillance, patient placement, and facilitating patient flow. We're trying to keep patients and staff safe in a world where most people are putting the pandemic behind them. The challenges facing infection prevention and control are similar to those faced by other healthcare workers. These challenges impact our priorities: resources, staffing, and capacity, the aging and retirement of experts with little to no succession planning, a lengthy learning curve to learn all the skills that are needed for the infection prevention field, a lack of mentors to help provide this, knowledge gaps, institutional hierarchies, power gradients, burnout, scope of work, organizational priorities, relevance of initiatives, competing priorities, and the ongoing issue of non-compliance. Over the past few slides, I've touched on things that form and complicate our practice and the setting of priorities and ultimately impact patient infections. So let's look now at some of the national data on healthcare-associated infection trends in Canada. In this country, the analysis and reporting of infection data is provided by the Canadian Nosocomial Infection Surveillance Program, known as CNISP. It's established in 1994. It's a collaboration between the Public Health Agency of Canada, the National Microbiology Lab, and the Association of Medical Microbiology and Infectious Disease Canada. Sentinel hospitals that are mostly acute care tertiary centers submit data prospectively on targeted infections as well as antimicrobial resistance. The data submitted are not as extensive as that collected by the Center for Disease Control through the National Healthcare Safety Network. The data shown here was collected from 3 single-day point prevalence studies conducted across Canada in 2002, 2009, and 2017. In these studies, infection prevention practitioners were required to review the charts of every inpatient in the hospital during the particular calendar day and document the presence of any of the designated infections using standardized NHSN surveillance criteria. The designated infections were urinary tract infection, pneumonia, C. difficile, surgical site infections, and bloodstream infections. Prevalence was highest in the ICUs, where the prevalence was actually almost double that of all the other units combined. And over the 3 surveys, urinary tract infections were the most common infection, followed by pneumonia, surgical site infection, bloodstream infection, and C. difficile. 35.6% of all infections were device associated. The prevalence studies demonstrated a significant decrease in pneumonia and central line associated bloodstream infections. Urinary tract infections, surgical site infections, and C. difficile infections also declined, but not significantly. ICU infections declined by 29.2%. The overall prevalence of infections demonstrated a 30.1% decline from the first to the last survey. A key learning was that strategies to prevent infections associated with medical devices needed to be further developed. Additional conclusions reached in the study were that improvements happened despite higher proportion of patients in the ICU. No single intervention was responsible. Multiple interventions were employed, including improved hand hygiene, multidisciplinary implementation of bundles, and antimicrobial stewardship. Antimicrobial resistance was uncommon, but increased slightly. The presence of healthcare-associated infections was noted to be higher than that reported by the Center of Disease Control. The explanation for that was believed to be differing patient populations, as the CNISP data is predominantly from large tertiary care hospitals with high-risk populations, compared with the mixed high and lower end general hospital data included in the CDC surveys. They acknowledge that the trends may not be representative of the general inpatient population in Canada, and that changes in NHSN definitions and changes in lab practices may have also contributed to changes in the data. In a separate study from 2011 to 2020, CNIS focused on device and surgical procedure-related infections. CLABSIs was the most common infection and represented 67% of all healthcare-associated infections included in this data. Analyzing the data on surgical site infections, it was identified that 70% of all surgical site infections were associated with primary total knee and hip replacement procedures. Gram-positive organisms, coagulase negative staphylococci and staph aureus, were the most frequent pathogens identified. CSF shunt and pediatric cardiac surgical site infections were stable. On the next slide, we'll look further at the data and trending with these infections. This chart displays the CLABSI rate per device days in four types of ICUs: adult, mixed, and cardiovascular ICUs, and neonatal and pediatric ICUs. The bottom green line shows the increased rate in the adult and mixed ICUs, and the orange line displays the 60% decrease in the neonatal ICUs. This line is the pediatric ICU, and this is the cardiovascular ICU. Overall, the rates in the adult ICUs, so the cardiovascular ICUs and the mixed adult ICUs, were similar to those reported in both the United States and Australia. This chart displays the trending for primary total hip and knee replacement procedures. Knee rates decreased 58%, and hip rates remained stable between 2011 and 2019, and then decreased significantly by 31% in 2020. It's not known what caused the decline in 2020. It may be associated with the arrival of COVID and the periods of time when limits were placed on hospitals on performing elective surgical procedures. However, a rapid decline at the same time was not noted in knee infections. We'll be able to interpret this further once we have data available from 2021 and beyond. In a separate study looking at trends in select organisms from 2017 to 2021, C. difficile rates decreased by 11%, while MRSA bloodstream infection rates increased by 35%. Analysis of the MRSA data demonstrated that 80% of the increase was in community-acquired cases. In the facility in which I've been working since the start of the pandemic, there has not been a single case of healthcare-associated bloodstream infection with any organism, while we have had several patients presenting with community-acquired MRSA and sensitive staph aureus bloodstream infections, mostly attributed to intravenous drug use. Rates of carbapenemase-producing anterior bacteriaceae have been low and stable nationally. I've seen a single case in 4 years in an outpatient who had a prior admission to a regional acute care facility. While our data are limited, we look forward to receiving the Canadian data collected since 2021 that will demonstrate how we've been doing with these key indicators throughout the pandemic and beyond. At this point, I'll turn the presentation over to Kathleen.
Thank you, Kathy, for that great intro and information about the trends that were being seen in Canada during the COVID pandemic. I'm Kathleen McMullen. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the trends that we saw in the United States as well. So early on in the pandemic, we had mostly results from single organizations. So just a couple of minutes, a couple of months after the pandemic started, we saw one publication from two single hospitals, one in St. Louis, Missouri, one in New York, New York, both with major COVID surges in March of 2020. And both of those hospitals noted significant increases in their CLABSI rates, and they were a major magnitude, 300 to 400% increases in those first couple of months of the COVID pandemic. Another single study out, single center study out of Denver, Colorado, looked at the four units in their hospital that housed COVID patients, compared them to the rest of the hospital during the COVID pandemic, as well as rates before the COVID pandemic. And they saw CLABSI rates 65% higher on those COVID floors. Single study out of Detroit, Michigan, saw an increase of 325%. Again, a huge increase in their CLABSI rates in the months soon after the COVID pandemic started. And then late in 2020, we had our first study out of a larger organization. So the Ascension Hospital System, which is a 78 hospital system, was able to do some really interesting comparisons because they had multiple hospitals to look at. So they looked at CLABSI rates 1 year prior to the pandemic and compared with 6 months post-pandemic. But they also split their hospitals into hospitals that had more COVID patients. So they saw that their hospitals with greater than 10% of their admissions being COVID patients had a standardized infection ratio of 2.4 times higher than those hospitals that had fewer COVID patients overall. This was also the first study that we had that looked at the organisms that were causing these CLABSIs, and they reported primarily common skin contaminants as well as Candida. Eventually, we were able to look at information from the United States as a whole. So most U.S. hospitals report their hospital-acquired infection data to the National Healthcare Safety Network, which is part of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and required reporting for federal reimbursement for many hospitals. They release reports of data once a year, and their first report for year 2020, which was the first year post-pandemic, compared data to 2019. And we saw some major increases in several of our HAIs. CLABSI, as we've been talking about, had a 24% increase in year 2020 with a 50% increase in ICUs with the CLABSI rates. We also saw pretty major increases in VAE, ventilator-associated events, as well as a 15% increase in MRSA bacteremia. In that beginning of the pandemic, we didn't see much change in CAUTIs, and we were seeing a nice refreshing decrease in surgical site infections and C. difficile. But again, the most concerning thing that come out of that data really was the impact on CLABSI because they have such high morbidity and mortality for our patients. There were several reasons that were hypothesized and then later proven as reason that we were seeing these increases in bloodstream infections and CLABSIs. At the beginning of the pandemic, we had shortages of personal protective equipment. So our healthcare workers were not wanting to use as many gowns and masks and gloves. And so they would go into the room, batch a bunch of tasks to do at one time, which led to some rushing and fatigue. Also, to avoid using as much personal protective equipment, we were bringing machinery like IV pumps out into the hallway, which decreased PPE use, decreased entries into the patient room, but also increased the risk as far as keeping tubing clean and not having as many providers going into the room. So they weren't able to keep an eye on the dressings and tubings and labels as much as we had been able to prior to the pandemic. Staffing shortages can't be stressed enough. When you're short-staffed, it obviously impacts quality. And we did a lot of innovative staffing, moving healthcare workers who weren't as used to doing some of these care tasks into these higher acuity areas because of short staffing. And then there was the illness of the patients. And so we'll look at a couple of studies related to this, but the patients who had COVID were sicker. They were there for longer lengths of stays. They had more likely incidents of central lines and they were in for a longer time, just leading to increased risk of the patient in general related to CLABSI and other hospital acquired infections. So we did have, as 2021 dawned, we had organizations, lots of them trying to work on this. There was a nice study out of a Nebraska hospital system that in 2021 did a deep investigation into their CLABSI. And I'm not going to say that their findings are representative of every hospital, but this is just an example of what many hospitals were finding. So supply shortages, CHD discs were in short supply and they were removed from their central line kit because there wasn't enough of them. But then when they were available in single supply, they weren't getting pulled and they weren't being used on patients even when they were available. The researchers noted that they had had a semi-annual in-person training for their nurses that had been halted because of COVID. They had also decreased their documentation burden. So this was something that many hospitals did during the COVID pandemic, decreasing the required documentation, allowing the healthcare providers to spend more time with patients. But one of the things that this hospital did to decrease their documentation workload was to decrease the amount of things related to central line care that were required. And they also reported staffing shortages, deploying alternate staff to new patient care areas and the struggles with training for that. They and many other organizations saw some increases. This is the national data in 2021. So now we're a little over a year past the pandemic, and we are still seeing an impact to our hospital-acquired infections. So CLABSI data increased by 7%. That's on top of the 24% that we saw in 2020. So continued increases. ICUs had another 10% on top of the 50% that they saw in 2020. Smaller increases in VAEs as well as MRSA bacteremias. This is the first year that we started to see a small increase in CAUTI, a 5% increase in CAUTI, with almost 10% of increase happening in ICUs. And then the decreases that we were seeing leveled off as well. There wasn't as much of a decrease as in C. diff in 2021, and there was no changes in our SSI rates. So there's another study from 2021 that explains a little bit of what we're seeing as far as those national decreases. This was a survey of 881 United States hospitals. And really interestingly, these hospitals reported that their CLABSI prevention metrics were pretty much the same post-pandemic as they had been several years prior to pandemic when the survey had last been done. They were reporting almost everyone was still using sterile barriers and CHG for skin antisepsis. 90% of the hospitals were using those CHG gel or dust dressings. But they noted that some CAUTI prevention practices had eroded from past years. And a lot of those CAUTI practices were related to staffing and nurse workload. So they reported a 6% decrease in nurse discontinuation protocols, 13% decrease in reminders to discontinue catheters, and 10% decrease in use of intermittent catheterization, which does have an increased nursing workload. So this was one of the first studies that really proved that impact of staffing and its impact on the hospital-acquired infections. So I titled this slide Response Plans because a lot of the literature from here on out, we're going to focus on really how people were adjusting, and eventually, spoiler alert, we have been a little bit successful. So this was a nice study from a single center in California where they, in their response, had some new things and just some reconvening of some of their old metrics. So they resumed real-time case assessment of all CLABSI, so looking at each infection in depth with frontline staff and seeing what they could learn from the infections, doing their data analysis and reporting. So they were talking with leaders of all the nursing units about the infections, as well as any process measures related to the infections, and increased to have targeted weekly line rounding. So trying to keep an eye on those practices related to staffing and workload that we know had shifted during the pandemic. So I chose to highlight this study because they had an impact on their patients that did not have COVID, but weren't able to impact the patients with COVID as much. So after their interventions, they had a 50% decrease in CLABSI rates in patients who were admitted to the hospital for some reason other than COVID. But the patients who were admitted with COVID-19 and being treated still had the same CLABSI rates. And this really shows the variation of the CLABSI increases that we were seeing. Some of it was related to processes and practices, and some of it really was related to the illness of these patients. I wanted to highlight several posters from the latest APIC conference. Most of these also are single studies, but single centers or even single units where people are starting to have success with their response plans. So I really liked this one from One Medical Surgical ICU. It was titled Collaboration, Consistency, and Communication. And that is going to be our mantra as infection preventionists and those of us trying to improve quality in healthcare for the next several years, I would think. So what this unit did to improve their CLABSI rates was standardize their case reviews. They used the apparent cause analysis format and then disseminated or shared their results. They had care conferences for their high-risk patients, and they did a lot of data sharing, making sure that everybody who's giving the care is clear about how well we were doing at the expected processes. In a different pediatric cardiac ICU, they had success by having weekly rounds with champions for central line care, keeping a close eye on those central lines. This was one of the studies that talked about cleaning. So they enhanced their cleaning of high touch surfaces, but with a lot of those increased acuity patients who were in their hospital room for longer, we know that sometimes we aren't as good at deep cleaning a hospital room with a patient in it as we are at discharge. So this hospital had success at improving cleaning of rooms while the patient was still admitted. They optimized their education and updated protocols, and they did that related to central line audits they had done and the opportunities that had been observed from those central line audits. Very similarly, another community hospital in the Midwest did that same thing, did 6 months of line observations and intervened on the fallouts that they saw in those observations in a more global manner to have success in decreasing their CLABSI rates. So you can see the work the hospitals were doing, the success that they were seeing in the most recent report, which is just a couple of weeks old now, about hospital-acquired infection changes in the U.S. in the year 2022. So comparing to 2021 data, we see the first decrease in post-pandemic time in CLABSI with a 9% decrease, 20% decrease in our ICU CLABSI. Really interestingly, I highlighted this for you. This was the first year that we reported increases in CLABSIs and neonatal ICUs. And I would say my organization actually was exactly the same. And so we're just starting to think and discover why that is. It does appear that NICUs were just more insulated from the impact of COVID in the first couple of years, maybe not as impacted in their processes and certainly in their staffing. But they did have a little bit of an increase in 2022, and I'm sure that other hospitals as mine intervened on that as they saw it. So we'll be keeping a close eye out for that with our 2023 data when it comes. So we also saw decreases in CAUTI, decreases in VAE, decreases in MRSA bacteremia, another small decrease in C. diff, which just continues to get better, and no changes in SSI. So that goes to our leads me to our second objective, and I'm going to probably continue to highlight some of the things that were in the literature from the end of that first objective. So I'm going to talk about rebuilding and reimplementing infection prevention practices, but I'm not necessarily going to talk about the practices in general that we need to be focusing on, more about tips and strategies for that rebuilding and reimplementing. So the first thing that is going to be key in impacting HAI rates, especially post-pandemic, is going to be a team. You're going to have a team continuing to talk about these things, probably month in and month out. And that team needs to be multidisciplinary to maximize the success. So of course, we'd have an infection preventionist on that team. The IP's role on that team is going to be looking at trends and rate data and process measure compliance, collecting that data and helping visualize it for the healthcare providers. Of course, delving into individual case discussions and chart review and talking about definitions that we follow for defining things like a CLABSI. Nursing, of course, is key to have on your team. It is important to have inpatient ICU nursing on a CLABSI prevention team, but I would argue the emergency room is also pretty key. They are the first person who sees many of our patients, and practices that happen in the ED can impact HAI rates. For your nursing representatives, you would like to have leaders as well as frontline staff. Leaders can be there to help with accountability, to help understand what accountability needs exist, but the frontline staff are really going to tell you what's happening day in and day out with your patients and help you identify areas for improvement or intervention. It's very key to have a provider on your team. I know sometimes it is a little bit more difficult to get a lot of providers on the team, but at least one who is a thought leader in the organization and who will be able to take the information coming from that team out to other providers. This person will be helpful on a CLABSI prevention team to talk about things like justifying a central line, insertion practices, and then again, taking any information of what this team is working on out to other providers and helping to hold other providers accountable to any new standards that you're developing. And then ancillary members of the team as well. So if you have educators for nursing or ancillary staff, they need to be involved to know what they should be educating to. If you have a vascular access team, central line champions, anything like that, of course, those people are going to know a lot about what's happening on the front line and help you identify areas to intervene. And in general, these ancillary teams are going to give you more insight into how the work is done. Okay, so once you have your team together, you're going to want to start intervening. Many hospitals will choose to focus on whether or not the central line or other vascular access is necessary. And it is important to have continued focus. If you don't have a central line in place, you can't have a bloodstream infection. But how you offer that focus and education and expectations is just as important as the idea to focus on it. So this is data information from one of my prior organizations where they had decided to focus on central line necessity with a daily review. Anything that you focus on, if you can encourage daily reviews, it's going to have more impact on and allow you to make change more quickly. This organization decided to set out indications for central lines, and there's no set list as far as how when a patient should have a central line in place. But setting out an indication, I shared this list with you: high-risk meds, vasopressors, poor peripheral access, long-term use where they would need a line of discharge, multiple peripheral lines, frequent lab draws. A list such as this that's agreed upon by your multidisciplinary team is important to have. But even more important is details behind the list. So what does high-risk meds mean? So I gave you this example where this organization got together even with their pharmacy colleagues and decided this is the list of medications that would meet the indication for central lines. For another example would be frequent lab draws. Is that lab draws once a day? Is it lab draws 5 times a day? Adding more definition to whatever list you come up with will help your healthcare workers be accountable and be able to apply the list to their work. Another important thing when you're talking about indications for vascular access or any intervention such as this, if you give a list of when you should use it, give guidance on when you shouldn't or what you should do when it doesn't meet the list. So for central line indications, if you have a different medication that doesn't meet your high-risk medication but does need to be given intravenously, guidance on is the peripheral line more appropriate or is the midline more appropriate will be helpful, again, for your staff to follow your expectations. So process measures. Most of these teams will identify a couple of things that should be done for every patient that help decrease overall risk of infection. I'm going to use CHG or chlorhexidine gluconate bathing. It's a pretty common intervention that we do with most central line patients, some hospitals, all patients, to decrease risk of hospital-acquired infections. So when you want to increase how often and how frequently process measures are done, it's important to go through an improvement sort of package. So we start with education, explaining the data and the science behind recommendations or why this should be done. We like to give the patient's perspective as well. It really helps bring it home to the coworkers and healthcare providers about the patient and how they feel about things. Then we set out a standardized process so that the process measure can be successfully completed, and then track and trend and give feedback on performance. And let's delve into each of these a little bit more deeply. So first off, this is an example of a huddle topic. It's a little small, but you guys should all have the slides and can hopefully zoom in. But we make these huddle educational topics. They're always just one page, but we encourage them to be hung on bulletin boards or put on the back of bathroom doors. So with just a minute or two of perusal, our healthcare providers can glean the pertinent information. So this one starts with the data, the evidence. It has a summary at the top about a couple of studies and interventions that show 23% lower infection rates, 28% lower bloodstream infection rates, 40% lower bloodstream infection rates in hospitals and organizations that are similar to ours. The bottom of this has some of that patient feedback. So we're able to get verbatim comments when we do surveys of our patients after they stay in our hospitals. And there's a gold mine there of interesting things that patients observe and how they feel about it. So for this education piece, we pulled a couple of negative ones where our patients had talked about not having a bath the entire time they were there, concern that it was a dangerous environment as far as infection, and then highlighting some positive ones. So it was patient stories of how she one felt really just terrible and dirty all over, but the action and activity of the bed bath and interacting with her nurse definitely helped her really improve how she felt about herself and about her care in general. So the second step when you are ensuring success with process measures is to set out a standardized process about how that activity should be done. So this is our example from CHG Bathing. It tells our healthcare providers exactly which product, which soap, which type of washcloths or basin to use, what their process should be, everything from shampooing the hair to cleaning the face, and then doing the CHG bathing from chin to toes. Details on what to do with dirty cloths, what to do for pericare, what to do with lines and drains, all of that information. It gets a little wordy, but it's a nice one-stop shop for your experienced coworkers to remind themselves on the process, as well as a very nice training tool for any new healthcare providers that come on board to your organization. And the final step is to track performance. So this is a really pretty, a little bit jumbled mess from one of our hospitals. But it even in a jumbled mess like this, you can still glean some pearls and help guide your work. So I'm going to point out the teal line at the bottom. That was one of our, these are different units and their compliance with our bathing protocols. So that teal line at the bottom is one of our units, which wasn't doing so well. We intervened in the last couple of months, and you can see their line came up very nicely toward where the other units are. There's the light pink line that you see starting to really trend down. So that's going to be our next unit for intervention and for talking with the leaders about how we can improve that performance. At the same time, this graphic also shows a sort of mustardy green color as well as a nice bright orange. Those are units that are doing very well and have a history of doing very well. Those are units to call out in any hospital meetings and recognize their performance, as well as maybe pair a leader from that unit with one of the leaders of a unit lower on the graphic so that they can have learning of the success and transfer that to other departments. So these are some other suggestions of process measures. I'm not going to go into them in detail, but they can all be rolled out in that similar sort of package of improvement. Comprehensive case assessment, I would argue that this is a very important key for your multidisciplinary team to be working on. And this is that concept of every infection that you do have, delving into them and answering information about what went right and what might have gone wrong. So we have a longer sheet that has a lot of very specific questions about the care that patients who have infections received, but we summarize it into this 10-question questionnaire, which we're going to go through on the next slide. But it's important to make a case for the importance of process measures and help really delve into, again, identify areas where improvement could be made and gives you evidence that this is leading to infections. And then the other nice thing about these case assessments, I have the words not preventable in quotes here. A lot of infection preventionists, we would like to believe that everything is preventable. I wish everything was preventable, but especially as you start to get your rates much lower, there are some complicating factors, including the definitions, the way our standardized definitions are written, as well as just the health and illness of some patients. So this allows you to focus and make sure you are doing everything that's right for your patients. And in cases where you had done everything right, then you can have that honest conversation about whether or not we know what to do to prevent this next infection. So for our CLABSIs, we make sure that everything for the insertional line was correct, that we did the checklist and that we adhere to all practices. We make sure that we audited the line at least weekly, as is our expectation. We make sure that the line was justified for at least 48 hours prior to the date of the infection. We note if there are any issues with maintenance of the line, either identified in that audit or in documentation by the providers. We look at that CHG bathing. For us, we define success as at least 6 of the 7 days prior to the infection. We look at documentation of how the line was maintained or the site was maintained, including the dressing integrity. And then a couple of special things. We are focused on blood culture contamination. So we note if we didn't use the technology to decrease contamination or if it wasn't treated as a full CLABSI. And then we also look to say we record if there is a definitional challenge, if clinically the providers believe something else was causing this infection, but because of the surveillance nature of our definitions, we still have to call it a CLABSI. And we also look at patients near time of death or near expiration. We know bacteremia is sometimes a side effect of dying. We try not to draw a lot of cultures at that time, but if we do have a CLABSI related to that situation, that is something else that we make sure we have documented and can talk about with our leaders. And then one final tip I will want to talk about is reinforcing technologies. So many of our organizations spend quite a bit of money on products that help our healthcare workers with some of those processes. But it's not always the easiest thing to get them used in a routine and a rigorous manner. So when you want to reinforce using the technologies that your organization has decided to invest in, reminding healthcare workers of why we have those technologies, as well as the with them, the what's in it for them or what advantage they get to using the products. And then anything you can do to increase the ease of using the product, where it's stocked, any signage to help with reminders to use it as well as how to use it. So this is an example of our reinforcement tips. We again did a huddle topic out on bulletin boards. We use alcohol impregnated caps. And so this education piece talks, number one, about what the advantage of the product is, the details of the alcohol impregnated cap, protecting that hub and keeping organisms off that hub. We also talk about the WIFM for the healthcare providers. If you're using this and it's used correctly, then it saves you from having to scrub the hub when you take that off. So that's sort of the double pros of using this piece of technology. And as far as ease, we actually have a couple different colors and types of caps that we use in our organization. So we have this education lined out to be very specific about which cap goes with which type of vascular access. So it's easy for them to pick the right item and to use it routinely. So with that, I will pass it back over to Kathy to discuss our third objective today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kathleen, for providing us with tips and strategies to help us re-implement practices to prevent bloodstream infections. To end the presentation, I'll provide an overview of evidence-based recommendations that should be implemented to reduce the risk of catheter-related bloodstream infections. It's been well recognized for many years that adopting prevention bundles has been shown to reduce the risk of infections, including catheter-associated bloodstream infections. Key to bundle success is the existence of a patient safety mindset or culture supported by leadership within a particular unit or facility. Success is also dependent on a consistently high rate of compliance or adherence to individual measures. I've chosen to focus on the 2022 practice recommendations from SHEA-IDSA, Essential Practices for Preventing CLABSI, recommended for all acute care hospitals. The reasons for this are they're the most current guidelines available. They've been developed by a multidisciplinary panel representing infectious diseases specialists, infection prevention and control experts, and vascular access experts. Their objective: and employ a rigorous methodology for the identification and review of high-quality published research. In the guideline, they've divided the recommendations into essential, pre-insertion, insertion, and post-insertion practice bundles recommended for everyone, and additional practices that can be considered if rates are high after the implementation of the essential practices. While I can only highlight the recommendations here, additional detail associated with each recommendation is provided in the guideline, and the guideline is open access and available through the link provided at the bottom of the slide. The pre-insertion bundle includes ensuring that you have easy access to evidence-based list of indications for use of central lines, required education and competency assessment of personnel involved in the insertion care and maintenance of central lines, and that patients in ICU should be bathed with a chlorhexidine preparation on a daily basis if they're 2 months of age or older. At insertion bundle includes the use of a checklist, which also includes documentation, and the documentation of compliance with the checklist should actually be done by the person who is not the person inserting the line. It includes hand hygiene, including or a preference for a subclavian site, all-inclusive catheter cart or kit should be used, ultrasound guidance, and that is most relevant in this expanded information related to the insertion of internal jugular or femoral central lines and the use of maximum sterile barrier precautions for workers, which include a mask and cap and sterile gloves, sterile gowns, and the use of a full body sterile drape for the patient. The use of alcoholic chlorhexidine antiseptic skin preparation as well prior to insertion. The post-insertion practice bundle should include the appropriate nurse-to-patient ratio and the limiting of float nurses in the ICUs, the use of chlorhexidine dressings for central lines in patients 2 months of age and older. Transparent dressing changes and site care should be performed with a chlorhexidine-based antiseptic every 7 days or immediately if the dressing is soiled, loose, or damp, and that changes to every 2 days if the gauze dressing has been used. Administration sets can be left up to 7 days. Exceptions are those used for blood products or lipid formulations. The catheter hubs, needleless connectors, and injection ports should be disinfected before access. And the guideline specifies the use of an alcohol chlorhexidine solution or a 70% isopropyl alcohol solution. They do acknowledge that there may be residual effect or a residual benefit from the use of chlorhexidine. The removal of non-essential catheters, which requires a daily assessment of need, and the performance of surveillance for CLABSIs in both ICU and non-ICU settings. If you've done all that and your infection rates are still high, they do provide a list of additional approaches that can be considered for the prevention of central line associated bloodstream infection. These are the use of an antiseptic or antimicrobial impregnated catheter itself. And in the document, they actually speak to this as being most helpful in high risk patients who have limited access with a recurrent history of bloodstream infections, or patients who have had recent implementation of a medical intravascular device such as a cardiac valve or an aortic graft. Use of an antimicrobial lock for long-term CVCs, and the patients that this is most indicated for are those same patients that are high risk and identified in the first bullet. Utilize infusion or vascular access teams, the use of antimicrobial ointments for hemodialysis catheter insertion sites, and use of an antiseptic containing hub or connector cap port protector to cover connections and IV access points. There are issues discussed in the document that are unresolved because they require further research. One is the routine use of needleless connectors, and that's because the reason that needleless connectors were originally implemented on lines was to prevent healthcare worker needle sticks, and it was really not for any additional benefit in terms of reducing infection risk. So it's really unknown whether it adds any benefit there. There's surveillance of other catheters, whether we should be conducting surveillance of other peripheral catheters, such as peripheral arterial and peripheral venous catheters. The use of standard non-antimicrobial transparent dressings. Research is needed around chlorhexidine-based products and resistance to chlorhexidine and what that means in a clinical environment. The use of sutureless securement, and whether or not mechanical disinfection with a chlorhexidine alcohol swab or a 70% alcohol swab and friction is still required when a needleless connector or port is an antiseptic cap is being used. The Infusion Nurses Society published updated standards of practice in 2021. The standards were developed by 11 nurses with expertise in vascular access. Section 3 is dedicated to infection prevention. I wanted to draw attention to this section because of their discussion around aseptic non-touch technique, or ANTT, which is a practice framework for the application of aseptic technique that originated in the United Kingdom and has been adopted around the world. It's not specific to infusion therapy and can be applied to other indications for medical asepsis. A principle of ANTT is that sterile key parts do not come in contact with anything that is not sterile. Key parts are the parts of equipment that, if contaminated, would provide a direct route for transmission of pathogens from the procedure to the patient, such as a needle or a cannula. Key sites include any point of entry into the patient, such as wounds, stents, and vascular access device insertion sites. The reality is we need to keep and not touch or contaminate the key parts or the key sites. I also wanted to touch base on the use of vascular access teams, as the SHEA IDSA guideline includes this as an additional approach, and there is discussion at many facilities regarding the re-implementation of vascular access teams that were widely used in the 1970s and 80s. In 2018, the Cochrane Review intended to perform a review comparing the use of vascular access teams for insertion and care with the use of a generalist model. The review failed because they were unable to identify randomized control trials addressing the issue. Studies located were not considered suitable to include in a Cochrane review. Non-qualifying studies were identified that some hospitals may consider sufficient to support practice change. Some of these studies showed better first-time insertion success with the use of teams, so less pokes in patients. Teams inserting peripheral intravenous were associated with less phlebitis, erythema, induration, and infiltration. Teams inserting central venous lines had lower iatrogenic complication rates, and teams were also associated with reduced bloodstream infection rates. Most recently, a study by Summerall Long et al. Published in the December 2023 issue of the American Journal of Infection Control describes their experience over a three-year period of time with the use of a central line insertion support team. This was conducted at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. The duties of the support team were to ensure the use of a clinical checklist and confirm compliance. They were responsible for observing and enabling infection prevention and control techniques, ensuring availability of supplies for insertion, and coaching. The outcome measure was bloodstream infections occurring within 1 week of line replacement. So bloodstream infections that occur within 7 days of insertion are generally considered to be related to the actual insertion procedure. They also observed greater than 100 observed insertions per month. The results were that the infections that occurred within 7 days of insertion reduced by 47%. The conclusion was that dedicated teams of nurses to assist with insertion can reduce the risk of bloodstream infections. This ends our webinar. Throughout, we've provided you with an overview of healthcare-associated infections, trends, and challenges in Canada and the United States, as well as tips, strategies, and evidence-based practice recommendations intended to assist you in reducing the risk of bloodstream infections in your facility. Perhaps we've even inspired you to make a change. On behalf of Kathleen and myself, thank you very much for your attention.